Vidal Riley moves to 8-0, 5 by way of, this time with a 4th-round TKO victory over Anees Taj. Now, Riley turned pro back in 2018, and since that time, he's only had 8 fights. That's very slow going for a fighter at this stage of their careers. Normally, a prospect is going to be fighting much more regularly than that. Vidal Riley was training YouTubers and all this kind of thing and fighting infrequently. And I think that reflected itself in some of his performances, where to me, Riley looked sluggish. He looked ring rusty. Whereas in this fight here against Anees Taj, I thought he looked sharp. This is the sharpest I've personally ever seen Vidal Riley. And I have to imagine that that is to do, at least in part, with the increased activity since signing with Boxer. So, for example, in 2022, he had 3 fights, and he's already had his first fight. We're in February of 2023. So that's 4 fights in pretty quick succession. Whereas prior to that, he didn't fight at all in 2021. He only fought once in 2020, twice in 2019, once in 2018. So, yeah, I think we're seeing improvements due to the increased activity, and we're seeing what Vidal Riley can actually do. Not that Taj was any great shakes or anything like that. A tough guy, yes, but certainly not one of the best fighters in the world at cruiserweight. So, Vidal Riley was boxing on the back foot in this fight, moving around. Taj was coming at him. Riley was sticking a jab on him. There were moments where Riley was caught with right hands, and you don't want to see that, particularly not at this level. So he's going to need to tighten that up significantly. But in terms of the fluidity, the speed, the timing, the rhythm, the balance, and all that kind of thing, it was a marked improvement from what I've seen before of Vidal Riley. And he managed to cut Taj very badly with a right hand, and that's a shot that kept landing throughout this short fight. Even after the cut, he was still landing it. And after the 3rd round, the referee and the doctor, etc., decided that it was too severe to allow Taj to continue. So Vidal Riley gets the victory. And as I say, I saw a lot of improvements there, but he was still getting clipped with right hands. You don't want to see that. That needs to be sorted out. And also, the punching power of Vidal Riley. He was hitting this guy flush numerous times, and I never even saw his legs buckle. Maybe Taj has got a really good chin. Maybe he's a Marius Watt type figure in the cruiserweight division rather than a heavyweight. I don't know. But from what I saw there, he doesn't strike me as, let's say, a David Haye type puncher. When Haye was at cruiserweight, fighting at this type of level, catching opponents that frequently and that cleanly with his right hand, he was flattening them. I mean, even Lawrence Okoli at this kind of level was putting these guys on the deck when he's catching them that cleanly and frequently. So I'm sure Riley has power, but it doesn't at this stage appear to be anything exceptional or outlandish. Obviously, power is not the be-all and end-all, but it is a nice thing to have. Most fighters do not have Oleksandr Usyk-level skills to be able to compensate for a lack of punching power at the highest level. So with regards to Vidal Riley, I'm just trying to weigh up his attributes and measure them against the top guys in the cruiserweight division. And obviously, the more we see of Vidal Riley, the more we'll know about him, the more he will reveal attributes about himself. Maybe he's got a really good chin, a big heart, determination. Maybe he's really good at switching his tactics up on the fly, so on and so forth. Or maybe not. We'll find out in due course. But let me know what you thought about his performance against Taj. Did you see the improvements that I saw? How far do you reckon he could go? And who would you like to see him matched up against? There's another cruiserweight prospect, also promoted by Ben Shalom, in Chevron Clark. Now, what I've seen of Clark thus far, I would favor Vidal Riley to beat him heavily right now. I know Chevron Clark can punch, but there seems to be a lot of vulnerability there in terms of defense and also punch resistance. Clark is only 4-0, but apparently they do want to move him quite quick due to his age. He's in his early 30s, whereas Vidal Riley is only in his mid-20s. So could they fight for a domestic title in the not-too-distant future, the way that Anthony Joshua and Dillon White did? early on in their careers, or George Groves and James DeGale, even Daniel Dubois and Nathan Gorman. As I say, if it were to happen, I've got Riley winning that all day long, maybe even early. Let me know what you guys think in the comment section below about Riley's performance, who he should fight next, and how far you think he can go. British super lightweight prospect Adam Azim moves to 8-0 with a 10-round unanimous decision win over Santos Reyes. Now, Azim is very talented. He's got fast hands, fast feet, very athletic, well-coordinated. He's got good balance, good rhythm. And going 10 rounds with this opponent, Santos Reyes, will be good experience for him. You want a prospect coming up to get the rounds in the bag. You don't want them blowing everybody out. So these are all positives. He dropped Reyes in the second round, but Reyes proved himself to be tough. He tightened up his defense. He didn't get dropped again for the remainder of the fight, nor did he get stopped. Here's where I have some reservations about Adam Azim. He holds his head up very high. He doesn't bend at the waist that often or that much. And there were moments in the fight where he was actually exchanging left hooks with his chin all the way up in the air. This is very dangerous. This is something that needs to be corrected. Also, he is in one of the deepest, most stacked divisions in the whole of boxing. You've got the likes of Regis Progre, Josh Taylor, Teofimo Lopez, Jose Ramirez, Ryan Garcia, Richardson Hitchens, Arnold Barboza, Sandor Martin, Jack Catterall, etc., etc. Very, very stacked division. And you've also got Devin Haney, who'll surely be moving up to 140 pounds in the not too distant future. So unbelievably stacked. So when I'm assessing Adam Azim, I'm thinking about him in context of these fighters. And from what I've seen so far, yes, there's potential there, but he's going to need a lot of improvement in terms of his technique from the defense and so on before I would be confident putting him in there against any of the names I just mentioned. I think that Sky and Boxer want to make money out of Azim as soon as possible. They're talking about him being the next superstar of British boxing. I think they need to pump the brakes on all that. I get it in terms of the money, and maybe Azim and his family want to make money as soon as possible, and therefore the best way to do that is to base him in Britain and start having him headlining shows and what have you. But I think over the longer term, for his development as a fighter who is in a very, very stacked division, personally, I think it's better for them to pump the brakes on all this hype, send him over to America immediately, and start sparring all the top guys out there as a prospect. Because the UK doesn't have anywhere near as many top fighters in this division as the United States does. Yes, there's Josh Taylor, there's Jack Catterall. Who else is there? There's nobody in the UK. Again, in the United States, Regis Progre, Teofimo Lopez, Devin Haney, who'll be moving up, Jose Ramirez, Arnold Barboza. Sandor Martin is Spanish. I'm not sure if he bases himself in the United States. But you've got Ryan Garcia, Richardson Hitchens, etc., etc., and a whole heap of other fighters who frequent these tough gyms in America who you wouldn't have heard of but are very good. So I think Azim would be far better off rather than just basing himself in the UK and doing all this sparring and all this stuff, but going out to America like Amir Khan did, right? He's been compared to Amir Khan and Prince Nassim and all this kind of thing. Amir Khan had to suffer a defeat, a devastating defeat to Bradus Prescott before he realized it's best to uproot from the UK and go to the United States and base himself there. The experience that Amir Khan gained in those American gyms, in my view, is the reason he was able to get through that Marcus Maidana fight and win it. I think if he hadn't gone to America, he doesn't win that Maidana fight. So that's what I would advise for Adam Azim. I don't think that's going to happen. Azim is with Shane McGuigan. Shane McGuigan parted company recently with Lawrence Okolie because Okolie has relocated to another part of the world. And Shane McGuigan has commitments to fighters in the UK. The gym doesn't revolve around one fighter. So for that reason, they parted company. I have to imagine it'll be the same with Adam Azim. If he decided he wanted to go to America, Shane McGuigan's probably not going to follow him there. So what I'm saying here, the thing I'm suggesting, is probably not going to happen for a variety of reasons, right? The money the Sky are trying to make off him early in his career, Ben Shalom and so on, and also the situation with the trainer. But that's my take on it. Yes, he's talented, he's athletic, and all those kind of things, but this division is unbelievably stacked. he needs to get a taste for how talented and how tough the fighters at the upper echelon of the division are before he gets there, in my view, if he's going to stand any realistic chance of actually beating these guys. This is not the heavyweight division. In the heavyweight division, if you're a prospect coming up, you don't need to go anywhere necessarily, because you can spar Anthony Joshua, at least prior to him relocating to the States. You can spar Anthony Joshua, you can spar Joe Joyce, you can spar Tyson Fury, you can spar Dillian White. You see what I'm saying? There's lots of choice there for you in terms of learning experience. But in the super lightweight division, not so much choice, not so much opportunity. The States is where it's at. So that's my take on it. The performance itself, it was good to get the rounds in. As I said before, the hand speed, the foot speed, the coordination, the punch variety, the balance, the rhythm, it's all there. But you need the defensive technique, you need the tactical awareness, you need the mental toughness to be able to make it at the very highest level, particularly in this division. And when it comes to mental toughness, generally speaking, the gyms in America are more hostile than British gyms. There are a lot of people in there talking smack, trying to intimidate other fighters in the gym. Even when they're sparring, they spar absolutely 100% full on a lot of the time. They're talking smack in the spars. It's like Sparta in there. In British gyms, there's often a polite, friendly atmosphere with not so much of the hostility. Now, that's generally speaking. There are some gyms in the UK, or at least some camps, that are typically very, very tough. Dillian White's camps, for example, are usually very tough. He goes in there and he's trying to take people's heads off, and people are trying to take his head off, and there's smack talk in the spars and all that kind of thing. Dillian White is the kind of British fighter who would fit in absolutely seamlessly in an American gym, right? Because he's that kind of smack talking, confrontational, hyper aggressive character that you typically get in those gyms in the States. So he would fit in no problem. But with a lot of other British fighters who come from more polite gyms in the UK, where you're not sparring, trying to take people's heads off all the time and talking smack, and it's not so hostile, it can be a bit of a psychological shock, a bit of a culture shock when they land in one of them tough American gyms, you see? But those tough American gyms will prepare you for what you're going to encounter in your actual pro fights at the top level of this division. It helped to prepare Amir Khan, and I also think it's helping to prepare Hamza Shiraz, who's a fighter at middleweight. He has been based in the United States for a while, and although he has some technical issues and stylistic issues and so on, from a mental perspective, I can see the toughness in him that was forged in those American gyms. So, as I say, that's my take on it. Give me your take in the comment section below. There are multiple reports circulating that Josh Taylor is set to ditch the Jack Catterall rematch altogether and instead fight Teofimo Lopez. Now, this news was put to Ben Shalom in a number of interviews over the past few days, and he's acting like he's baffled. He's acting like he thought the Jack Catterall rematch would be rescheduled. He said there's a contract in place. Now, what we know from history is that fighters who pull out of certain contests with injuries, whether they're real or fake, often divert and take a different fight instead, despite having a contract in place. A few examples of this would be David Haye. He was supposed to fight Vitali Klitschko. He pulled out of the fight. I can't remember whether he cited an injury or whether it was something else, but he pulled out of the Vitali Klitschko fight and instead signed to fight Nikolai Valuev. Later on in his career, he signed to fight Manuel Cha. He pulled out of that fight with a hand injury, quote unquote, and then announced that he was fighting Tyson Fury about 2 or 3 weeks later. Vladimir Klitschko did something similar. He signed to fight Derek Chisora twice, pulled out twice. The second time, I think it was just a week or two before the fight was supposed to take place with Chisora. He then, very shortly after pulling out of the Chisora fight for a second time, announces that he's fighting David Haye. And to my knowledge, nobody got sued in those situations. So it seems as though an injury can act as a convenient loophole, for lack of a better term, to get out of a contract legally. Is that the case here with Josh Taylor and Jack Catterall? Will he be fighting Teofimo Lopez next? And will there be no contractual ramifications for not going ahead with that Jack Catterall rematch? At the end of the day, to my knowledge, Josh Taylor isn't signed to Ben Shalom and Boxer. He's with Top Rank. So Ben Shalom presumably isn't going to be privy to a lot of the things that are going on with Josh Taylor. Hence, stating that he's baffled at the news that Taylor could be fighting Teofimo Lopez rather than rematching Jack Catterall. From what I've seen online, there is a lot of backlash from the fans. They think that Josh Taylor owes Jack Catterall that rematch because many people feel like Catterall was robbed on the scorecards first time around, and Taylor promised Catterall the rematch. He signed for the rematch. So to then just ditch it and go in a different direction, it has angered a lot of British boxing fans. Josh Taylor has gone down in their estimation, not just in terms of his ability as a fighter, but in terms of his integrity. That's the general sentiment that I'm seeing from boxing fans online. In any event, if he does go ahead and fight Teofimo Lopez next, how do you see that fight going? Especially given the fact that Lopez hasn't looked impressive of late. A lot of people weren't impressed by the Sandor Martin fight. He obviously lost to George Kambosos and so on. Josh Taylor is obviously a southpaw like Sandor Martin, and he has similar dimensions to Martin. He's got a better resume than Martin. He isn't a small southpaw like Vasyl Lomachenko. These are the things that we should consider. I think it's a really fascinating fight with Teofimo Lopez. I'm going to assume that would be in the United States because, again, Ben Shalom doesn't promote Josh Taylor. He seemingly wants to make the Catterall rematch. Taylor is maybe pulling a fast one, maybe even in the eyes of Ben Shalom. So I would expect Taylor Lopez to take place in the States. Taylor will almost certainly be paid an awful lot more money than he'd be getting for a Jack Catterall rematch. And it's a more prestigious fight. So I can see the appeal for Josh Taylor taking a Teofimo Lopez fight rather than a Jack Catterall rematch. The risk-reward is much better fighting Lopez than it is rematching Jack Catterall. And I'm not condoning what Josh Taylor's doing here, by the way. I just understand the motive. If this is indeed what he's doing and these reports do turn out to be accurate. So I'll leave it there. Let me know what you guys think in the comment section below about Josh Taylor apparently, reportedly, scrapping, walking away from the Jack Catterall rematch and taking on Teofimo Lopez instead. Let's recognize the elephant in the living room here. There is clearly, at this point, some funny business going on with this Alexander Usyk Tyson Fury fight. Clearly, they've been negotiating for about 5 months now, and they still haven't got it over the line. When they started the negotiation process, we were hearing from particularly Team Fury, but also all the Fury fans, about how quickly this fight would get done, because Fury doesn't mess about, and when two fighters really want to face each other, negotiations are very straightforward. But as I say, 5 months on, and there is no fight. And it also shows how dishonest Tyson Fury fans are, and I guess birds of a feather flock together. Since Tyson Fury himself is very dishonest, he attracts dishonest people. So they were all saying that the Usyk fight was already done prior to Tyson Fury facing Derek Chisora. They were acting like that fight signed, sealed, delivered, already in the bag. They're just going to announce it after the Chisora fight. Absolute load of rubbish. I said at the time that the fight wasn't done. Usyk and his team may have agreed terms, but Fury hasn't. And until both sides agree terms and put pen to paper and sign contracts, then you have no fight. As far as I'm concerned, there is no way that these negotiations could drag on for this long unless one side isn't as keen on this fight as the other. Somebody is running down the clock. Somebody is stalling this situation. Now, does it mean that they don't want the fight altogether? I hope not, and that isn't necessarily the case. Tyson Fury did talk about an injury after that Derek Chisora fight, which would need 6 to 8 weeks to heal. Now, some would say, why doesn't he just come out and say that's the reason that the negotiations are being dragged out because of the injury? Well, maybe he thinks it's a bad idea to let Usyk on about how severe the injury is. Obviously, he already let the cat out of the bag after the Chisora fight. Maybe he did that impulsively and wasn't thinking. Maybe he wants to go into the Usyk fight having Usyk believe that he's 100% completely healthy and he doesn't have any chinks in his armor or any issues. So, best case scenario, Tyson Fury has this injury. He needs more time to recuperate and recover from it before going into the Usyk fight. So he's trying to long out the negotiations as much as possible to allow for that. Worst case scenario is he doesn't actually want the fight at all. He instead wants to fight Francis Ngannou, perhaps for more money than he would get fighting Alexander Usyk. At the end of the day, Fury's all about the money. That's what he cares about the most. The majority of fans have already given him the crown as the best heavyweight in the world. So what incentive is there for him to face Alexander Usyk in his next fight if the fans already say he's better than Usyk anyway? You see what I'm saying? This is the danger of giving any fighter, not just Fury, any fighter in any division, that crown before they've actually earned it. Fury has beaten Deontay Wilder a few times. He's beaten Dillian White, Klitschko several years ago. He hasn't beaten Alexander Usyk, but yet everybody's saying he's the best in the division. Usyk can't touch him, so on and so forth. So in that situation, with a fighter who loves a pound note, and there's nothing wrong with that, in Tyson Fury, he's saying, well, I don't need to take this risk fighting Usyk. They already say that I'm better than him anyway. I'd rather fight Ngannou for a king's ransom. And so how do I avoid this Usyk fight without making it look obvious, without just blatantly pulling out? Well, I can run down the clock. I can nitpick the contract. I can make the contract so unappealing to Alexander Usyk that he won't agree to my terms. And eventually, hopefully, he walks away from the table. And I can blame him for not wanting to fight rather than people blaming me. Now, that is, as I say, the worst case scenario. I hope that's not what's going on. Best case scenario, Fury just needs more time to recuperate from his injury, but he doesn't want to make it obvious that he has such a serious injury. Time will tell. I'm praying that we still get an announcement in the next week or so, because you have to remember, the original deadline for this fight was March 4th, I believe. March 3rd or March 4th. Well, that's obviously not going to happen, is it? Then it's been pushed back to April. Will it get pushed back even further than that? I mean, if the fight is going to happen in late April, we need an announcement before the end of this month, surely, right? To allow for the promotion and what have you. So let's just call it what it is right now, people. Let's recognize the elephant in the living room. There is some funny business going on here. Somebody is trying to run down the clock. You look at the situation in Saudi Arabia. Why on earth wouldn't Tyson Fury take the money the Saudis were offering him over there? Why wouldn't he do that? Usyk said that, or his team, that he was happy with what he was being offered in Saudi, but yet Fury's not. What's that all about? Are we to really believe that they'd be offering him less money to fight in Saudi than he would get fighting Usyk in the UK? And of course, they can mess around and say, well, if we only give Usyk 30%, then we can get the same or a bit more money than we get fighting Usyk in Saudi Arabia. And I'm not saying it is 30%. I'm just throwing an arbitrary figure out there because we're not privy to the exact splits that they're talking about if the fight takes place in London. But hypothetically speaking, if it was that, obviously Usyk is not going to want to accept 30%, is he? That's an insult. Now, is it possible that it's Team Usyk that are running down the clock and it's them who are nitpicking the contract and stalling for time? Well, yeah, it's possible. But when I look at the track records of both fighters, I think it's far more likely that Tyson Fury would be doing something like that rather than Alexander Usyk. And a lot of people struggle with this idea that Tyson Fury would avoid a fight. I don't know why, because he's avoided numerous fights in the past, and it's not a matter of him being scared. It's a matter of him putting his business hat on and thinking from a business perspective before he thinks from a fighting macho perspective. Because people seem to have this idea in their head that Tyson Fury is this macho Gypsy King warrior who will take on any man at any time in any location. That's never been the case with Tyson Fury. That's all Fury hyperbole. Yes, he has taken risks in his career, big risks at certain points, but they were calculated risks. He fought Vladimir Klitschko in Germany because who else was he going to fight? He was 23 or 24 fights in. And if you wanted a title shot, you had to go to Germany, just like every other contender, just about, and fight Klitschko over there. So yeah, he had to take that risk, like David Haye did, like, as I say, most other Klitschko opponents did. He fought Deontay Wilder in the United States. Yes, it's a risk, particularly after coming back, losing all that weight and so on. But he had the option to go the Anthony Joshua route. He had the option to fight Tony Bellew, Dillian White, Anthony Joshua, but he chose not to. So he weighs up risk-reward and he says, this route isn't as favorable to me in terms of risk-reward as this other route. He's always been doing that. When he was supposed to fight David Price for the British title back in the days, he decided that the risk-reward for the Price fight wasn't favorable for him. So he decided to go in a different direction. Bear in mind, around that time, he was going life and death with John McDermott. I know this was a bit after that, but it wasn't too far removed. Going life and death with John McDermott was David Price wiped John McDermott out in one round. So Tyson Fury back then, of course, was nowhere near as good as the Tyson Fury we have today. So I don't see why people think it's outlandish to say that Tyson Fury avoided David Price back then, because that's absolutely what he did. David Price was filling out the Echo Arena. David Price back then had a bigger following in the UK than Tyson Fury did. There was more hype around David Price. So from a commercial standpoint, that would have been lucrative for Fury to take the Price fight at that stage. But he didn't. He thought it was, again, back then when Price was undefeated and knocking everybody out, too big a risk for not high enough reward for his liking. So Fury's always done this kind of thing. I mean, even with Dillian White, he eventually fought and knocked out Dillian White in a very good performance. But a couple of years prior, when Dillian White hadn't been knocked out by Povetkin yet, when he was on this very good run and he was knocking people out, White offered to fight Tyson Fury, and Fury said, I'll do it if the WBC diamond belt is on the line. The WBC said, no problem, we can accommodate that. And then Tyson Fury went and fought Tom Schwartz instead. Fury's got a long history of doing this kind of thing. He didn't fight Dillian White until a couple years later when White had been knocked out by Povetkin. And even then, it was a mandatory defense, so Fury had to take it. So Fury is not a straightforward guy to deal with in a business sense. Again, I'm not saying he's scared of anybody. I don't think Fury is scared of anybody. But he's got that business hat on. He's weighing up risk-reward. He's thinking, this fight makes me more money than this fight, and the more lucrative fight is less dangerous. So it's a no-brainer. I should take the more lucrative, less dangerous fight. I think that's how Tyson Fury assesses a lot of these situations. Again, I hope that that's not what's going on here with this Alexander Usyk fight. I hope it's maybe injury recovery. Either Fury is stalling the negotiations so he can recover from an injury, or perhaps even Usyk stalling negotiations so he can recover from an injury. I hope that's what it is. That's the best case scenario. But it wouldn't at all shock me if Fury is looking to fight Francis Ngannou instead and doesn't want the Usyk fight next. That would not shock me at all. I'd be the least shocked person in the universe, because I know Fury's track record. There is a pattern of behavior with Tyson Fury over a number of years, which you have to take into account in this current situation. Anyway, let me know what you guys think in the comments section below.